This episode of the Shameless Book Club is brought to you by Bailey's Irish Cream Liqueur, inspiring indulgence through me time moments.
Shameless Media.
Hey, book lovers. Today, Bree Lee and Sahani are discussing the literary trend of sad girl novels and how Bree's latest book deviates from this trend. You may be familiar with Bree's non-fiction books, Eggshell Skull and Who Gets to Be Smart, but her newest book, The Work, is her first foray into fiction, and it will be coming out on the 3rd of April. Very excitingly, Bree will be at the Melbourne Writers Festival, which is taking place from the 8th to the 12th of May. We've popped a link in the show notes if you're interested in attending. Before we get stuck into this conversation, let me briefly explain what a sad girl novel is. The protagonist is often an insecure and aimless young woman in her 20s or 30s who feels disillusioned by her career, her love life is in disarray, and she's self-absorbed but also consumed by self-doubt. We hope you enjoy listening to this conversation.
Hey Bree, welcome to the Shameless Book Club and congratulations on your latest book, The Work.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So our listeners at home may be familiar with your previous work, including Eggshell Skull and Who Gets to Be Smart. How does it feel releasing a book off the back of all that success?
I am so excited. I've been working on this book for 5 years now, and it's the first time I've been able to go into a book tour being really excited to talk about the subject matter without it having any kind of significant personal trauma or being about really rigorous, heavy, researched hot button topics. And that's not to say that the work, my novel, doesn't talk about things that I think are really important. It absolutely does, but there's no dread. I'm like all the excitement that has happened before and none of the dread that I have felt before.
So you're very well versed in nonfiction writing, but this is your first fiction novel. How did the process of writing fiction and nonfiction differ?
It's completely different. I think the best analogy I can think of is like a painter trying to do sculpture. There are some things that are similar, things like pace. You know, even if you write a memoir and it does come from your real life, you draft it really honestly, but then in the shaping and editing process, you still have to think about the reader and think about the reader's experience. So something like pace is, I think, exactly the same. You know, my absolute dream is when people read my books and say like, oh, I couldn't put it down. Or like I've, you know, stayed up all night to finish it or finished in 2 days, whatever. And that's pace. But pretty much everything else is different. I had to kind of trick myself into the drafting process because I didn't know how to write fiction. And so for me, that looked like a lot of research. So that I kind of, you know, I went and lived in New York and I was reading and listening to and watching so much about visual art and the art industry and taking so many notes that I kind of tried to take the techniques and the kind of preparatory research approaches that I knew from nonfiction and just try to feed them into fiction. But it's also just a lot more fun. It's so much more fun. I had a really good time writing this book.
Well, the possibilities are endless, right?
Yes.
So in the world of fiction, many people have spotted a literary trend called the sad girl novel trend, which we'll be spending a lot of time in this episode talking about. Why do you think sad girl novels appeal to so many young women?
I mean, I have a few different theories. The one I'm going with at the moment is that it's our generation's version of the Bridget Jones Diary effect. There is something, when a so-called sad girl novel is done well, it's very real and it's very relatable, and it makes a reader feel like they are not alone in struggling with certain things in their life. And that sense of solidarity or that sense of connectedness or, you know, that really special feeling you sometimes get if you're reading a book and you feel seen or you feel like you can see a character and you just get them. I think that's what a lot of readers are getting from this gigantic so-called sad girl novel genre.
Yeah. Are there elements of the sad girl novel that appeal to you?
I think that subgenre has become so broad over so many years now to have become almost meaningless. And I think within that genre, there are really, really strong examples and then there are weak examples. And in the same way that I would respond to a book of any genre that's really good, I will love it. I'm really passionate about not being wanky and not being sort of snooty or highbrow about so-called literary fiction compared to commercial fiction. And I think all reading is good reading. And I am completely open to having a brilliant transformative experience with any type and genre of book.
Mm. Do you consider yourself to be the target audience of this subgenre?
Well, yeah, probably. Smack bang in the middle. I mean, what's also interesting is, and I should preface this by saying, I'm a total romantic about writing and I'm a total romantic about reading and about books, but I am a cynic about the creative industries.
Yeah, that's fair.
And to me, those are very different things, and I'll speak really frankly about the industry and the things that I think are kind of bullshit about it, like media publishing, you know, the art industry, which comes through, I think, in my novel. They yeah. all share the similar issues, but I still do love books and I love reading and I believe in it and I want to be a writer until I die. All of which is to preface my answer to that question by saying one of the reasons sad girl novels, so-called sad girl novels, are so big is because they are mostly written by and mostly written for like the demographic who purchase books.
Mm-hmm.
Books overwhelmingly are a middle-class women's interest.
Mm.
And I'm not making an evaluative statement about that. It's not about whether that's a good or a bad thing. These books are written by or for the type of people who walk into Dimmicks or who shop on Booktopia overwhelmingly.
Yeah.
There is a reason why the term has now been in use for so many years and now applies to so many books.
Yeah.
It's just the industry feeding demand.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how people have said that there's a recent rise in these books, because I don't necessarily think that this subgenre is anything new. Like, take Virginia Woolf, Sylvia Plath, Charlotte Bronte. Do you think it's just a rebrand of what we've already been reading for decades?
If what we are talking about is basically a book that explores the interior life of a woman, full stop, then yeah, this terminology is just the latest way to, if we're being generous, find connection between lots of different types of artworks and develop a term that kind of catches them under one umbrella so that people can find more of what they want.
Yeah.
If we're not being generous, it's just the latest way that art made by and for women gets infantilized and denigrated as being a trend and not worthy of being taken seriously.
Yeah, well, you see it not just in literature. You also see it in TV shows and movies with like Fleabag, and you mentioned Bridget Jones's Diary.
Mm.
And also even music, like sad girl music is definitely a thing, with Phoebe Bridgers and Lana Del Rey being classified like that. Do you think there's a through line across media?
What I would say is that we live in such an extraordinarily exciting time for the democratization of taste.
Mm.
There used to be a lot more men in gatekeeping positions in culture. Yeah. Thanks to the internet, there is now a much more direct line between creators and consumers. And that feedback loop has tightened, but it has also kind of broadened in terms of like everyone gets to have their say and everyone gets to share what does and doesn't resonate with them.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a theme that has emerged across all these different art forms, then it's probably because the people consuming that are just being loud about liking it.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I'd love to dive into some common tropes that are seen in sad girl novels. The first trope I'd like to touch on is how the protagonist's love life is always in disarray. Whether it's toxic, unfulfilling relationships or unpleasant casual sex or worse, dissociative sex. Even you have previously spotlighted unpleasant sex in your memoir, but in contrast, there's a lot of great sex in your latest book. What influenced you to make that inclusion?
So as a reader in sort of 2019, 2020, I was getting really tired and also just really bummed out by how much bad sex I was reading on the page. And I don't mean badly written sex scenes, which is also a separate problem. But, you know, I just mean, and I'm not even talking about sexual assault here. I'm just talking about sex that for, and in particular with this sort of so-called sad girl genre, heterosex, that is just unsatisfying and unfulfilling. Because, we can talk about why, but I think one of the problems I have with many so-called sad girl novels is this idea of heteropessimism.
Mm.
This fair enough but unhelpful response that if you're a straight woman or a woman that does have sex with men, you're kind of doomed because men suck. And there's nothing you can do because men are just so hopeless. Not only can they cannot find the clitoris, they can't do the laundry. It's just always going to be like this and it's awful.
Yep.
And I was a woman in my late 20s when I started writing my novel, and I was reading about all of these women in their 20s going into their early 30s, all just having such incredibly underwhelming, shitty sex. And I was really tired of it.
Yeah.
It already was not reflecting the women I knew in my life. And mainly I was like praying that it got better.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in my novel, there's, you know, a male and a female protagonist. They have half of the story each in alternating chapters. But it was really important to me that the male, Pat, is in his late 20s. But the female, Lally, she's in her early 30s. And she knows what she wants and is willing and able to communicate what she wants. And a really tricky, nuanced, difficult question to ask about so-called sad girl novels is whether or not the protagonists in these books are just not saying what they want and need in sex, or if they can't say what they want and need during sex. And that is, I mean, fiction and a novel is the perfect sort of artistic medium to explore that, what all of the sort of contributing pressures and fears are around that. But I know for sure that when I was working on my novel, I wanted to not do that at all, to have a woman who is in her 30s, early 30s, who is not afraid of going after and saying what she wants and therefore getting much more satisfying sex. Yeah. I mean, I was just in my late 20s praying to God that for my sake and all of our sakes, that hopefully as you age, you can shrug off this like, oh, I've got to be a cool girl and not make any demands and just be happy with the sort of crumbs and crummy sex I am given.
Yeah, you've kind of already touched on this, but do you think the saturation of sex being portrayed as unenjoyable for women is dangerous?
I don't know about dangerous. Do you mean like because there's a risk that it will then just like perpetuate the thing that it's trying to critique? Yeah, I mean, dangerous is a strong word, especially with my background in talking about things that do perpetuate like really horrific, like bad like sexual assault, dangerous. But I do think it's definitely depressing. It is. Am I allowed to swear? It's depressing fuck that a lot of these authors are like, you know, these like brilliant minds and brilliant women. And it is an undeniable trend across this subgenre that there is just a lack of women writing great sex. And I'm more interested in what that says about us and what that says about our culture right now. And the fact is, this is like, you cannot get around this. Most of the protagonists in these novels are women from comparatively privileged backgrounds. They're not, you know, a really important thing to note is that although some of them are broke, they're not really poor. You know, none of the women in a so-called sad girl novel are single mothers of three on a disability support pension. If we read a book where that was the protagonist, that we wouldn't call it a sad girl novel.
Yeah, exactly.
Part of the sad girl novel is how middle class it is. There are a lot of intersections of identity that the sad girl protagonist often doesn't struggle against. And if even that woman who is otherwise doing okay and sort of should be empowered in her life as a woman, especially in her late 20s going into her early 30s, if even she cannot just say to the person she's choosing to be in bed with what she likes and what she wants, that is grim. That is really, really grim.
Yeah, I totally agree. I also think, like, on the flip side, I imagine sad girl novels can also make people feel seen and unashamed of unpleasant sexual experiences as well. Kind of like what you touched on before, like the relatability.
Absolutely.
But the work, sorry, going back to the work now, but the work demonstrates female sexuality in a different light, which I don't think we see enough of. The sex scenes were seriously excellent.
Thank you.
Everyone that has picked up the book in the office has given it high praise and said that in particular. And you kind of touched on it earlier when you said some sex is written badly. So I have to ask, how do you write sex well?
Oh my God. Like, oh, you really have to forget that you have parents. You have to really... In my opinion, you have to write first and foremost for yourself. You have to completely forget that anyone else is ever going to be reading it. And the other hot tip, in my opinion, is do not ever use euphemisms. You know, there are no throbbing members. No, like, well, just call things what they really are.
That reminds me of 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yeah, but the other, like, an interesting, funny tidbit is that, you know, spent 5 years working on this book. The first sort of version of it was double the length that it needed to be. It was like 200,000 words. And the only two things that didn't change through the very long process of shaping and editing and perfecting this book, most of the dialogue between Pat and Lally, like that really quick banter, that sort of witty repartee, yeah, that didn't change. And none of the sex scenes changed at all. And I'm really glad that I didn't. There's a heat to it and there's a realness to it that I'm glad we didn't touch or try to fiddle with too much. It just works.
Hey guys, it's Mish here. Before you hear the rest of this interview, I am so excited to tell you about our sponsor today, Bailey's Irish Cream Liqueur. As always, Bailey's is reminding us to take some time for ourselves amongst the busyness of everyday life. No matter how hectic your schedule is, Bailey's thinks it's important to indulge every now and then. One thing that doesn't change as the weather cools down is my love for a good iced drink. I recently discovered Bailey's Vietnamese Latte. Not only is it deliciously creamy, but also so beautiful to look at and perfect for impressing any guest you might have over. It creates the most gorgeous marbling pattern as you pour the velvety Bailey's Irish Cream Liqueur in. If you're feeling a little extra and want to make it a main character moment, try topping it with some dark chocolate curls too. So decadent and yummy. If you're over 18 and are interested in an indulgent treat, head online or in store to shop the Bailey's range. And as always, remember to drink responsibly. Thank you so much to Bailey's for making this episode of the Shameless Book Club possible.
So another trope I'd like to discuss in Sad Girl novels is how the protagonist often hates her job and feels directionless about her career. Throw in some critiques of capitalism and you've got a bestseller, essentially. Yep. Why do you think so many young women like this discourse so much?
I think this is a specifically generational thing, and it comes back to that idea of kind of, maybe not solidarity is a strong word, but, you know, reading about these things makes in particular millennial women or women on either side of the millennial age bracket feel less alone, because our generations and our sort of decades in particular were sold this idea that you not only can but should find work that, yes, pays well, but that, like, you know, like augments your identity, you know, work that is somehow intrinsic to your sense of self and
like an extension of you.
Yeah. You know, find out what you love doing and you'll never work a day in your life, or get someone to pay you for doing it, whatever that thing is. Mm-hmm. And that you can, you know, achieve your dreams and like bust your guts and you will be rewarded. And then, you know, women get to the workplace and it's not that.
Yeah.
The fact is that not everyone can have a job that somehow miraculously completely reflects their sense of self kind of creatively and ambitiously. Also, the workplace is patriarchal. People will push you out. Your boss is more likely to be a dude who doesn't, on some level, either subconsciously or very consciously, like women. And so right at the time that women are in their late 20s, early 30s reading this fiction about these protagonists also struggling with their work or career having somehow stalled, it's relatable.
One of our listeners, Liz, actually wrote in and it provided an alternative suggestion. She said that the reason young women love the discourse now is because after the pandemic, many people felt disillusioned with work. So I think this phenomenon is called the Great Resignation. Do you agree that this might be the case?
I think those are connected things, though.
Yeah.
I think that if you're doing work that pays well and fulfills your sense of self in a workplace that respects you, you're probably not going to be a part of the Great Resignation. If you do work that is meaningful to you with people who you like, you're not going to want to quiet quit.
Yeah.
Like, to me, those are like the same problem, different parts of the same problem.
So one of the protagonists in the work is very much an ambitious career woman who wants to get the bag. She chases success in such a glittery way, investing so much of her time and money in a gallery, no less. The protagonist is in many ways the opposite to what you see in Sad Girl novels. Why did you decide to characterize her like this?
Lally's motivation with her work is intrinsic to who she is. Mm-hmm. In the very, very early stages of thinking about the themes I wanted to write about, mm-hmm. it's love slash sex, money slash capitalism, and art. Mm-hmm. So love, sex, and art. How money affects love and how money affects art. And it wasn't the case that I thought of this character, Lally, and then made her really driven. Lally is driven. Mm-hmm. And that honestly reflects much more accurately the women I know and love in my life.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this so-called sad girl who is struggling with her career isn't realistic. Like, mm-hmm. I know that that's realistic. But what I don't see on the page enough in contemporary realist fiction is the women I know in my life who are clear on what their ambitions are and yeah. go after them, frankly, sometimes to the detriment of other parts of their life. And so when we meet Lally, yeah, she has one really great friend, Jen, but she's only really got one.
Mm.
And she's got a great relationship with her mum, but she doesn't have any kind of broader support network. She starts seeing Pat, who's the other protagonist, but I think it's fair to say that the space she allows him in her life mm-hmm. is very limited because her work is her number one priority.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the flip side of the coin of capitalism. You know, sad girls in so-called sad girl novels
That's
are struggling.
Very well put.
Yeah, they're struggling because their career has sort of paused because they've yeah. been sold a false dream or a false hope. Mm-hmm. And in my book, it's kind of the opposite, where it's like, well, here is the result. If you do go hard and yes. like play the game the way you're supposed to, this is what is at risk of happening.
I love it. That's so well put. It's like two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
For sure. So my next trope that I'd like to discuss, and I think it's the most valid criticism of sad girl novels, is how they're overwhelmingly white and therefore only spotlight a very narrow view of women's issues, and often their issues are still steeped in privilege.
Mm.
Can you speak to this sentiment a bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I already mentioned about how I think class is a component of this. Like,
yeah,
if we're talking about privilege and capitalism, it's class and race. And yeah, if it was a single mum of three on disability support, we wouldn't call it a sad girl novel. Mm-hmm. Where I think this gets really interesting, and there's a really great book I'm going to recommend as a kind of, not an antidote to this, but an example of how it can be done well, which is A Lonely Girl is a Dangerous Thing by Jesse Too.
Yeah, I've read that
great Australian fiction from, what, like 3 years ago? A few years ago.
A few years ago, yeah.
So when I mentioned earlier this kind of thorny issue about exploring when a woman does and doesn't have agency, you know, when a woman could take control of her life and for some reason just isn't, versus when she is in a situation that is actually not in her control.
Yeah.
The protagonist in Jesse Too's novel, A Lonely Girl is a Dangerous Thing, is an extraordinarily talented and hardworking classical musician. She's also a woman of color. She's an Asian woman in the classical music scene, which in Australia is, and from what I read around the world, extremely racist. It's a place of white supremacy. It's classicism, these big institutions who have an idea of mm-hmm. what a virtuoso looks like.
Yeah.
And it does not look like the protagonist in Jesse Too's novel. So the protagonist is struggling with her career in a way that we have been talking about is like a recurring theme in so-called sad girl fiction. Mm-hmm. But whereas a lot of, I would say, lesser sad girl fiction just has a protagonist kind of wallowing and blue but not doing anything about it. And she's from comparative class and racial privilege and she could do something about it, but mm-hmm. she just isn't because she's just sort of feeling stuck the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas A Lonely Girl is a Dangerous Thing explores what options are available to a woman who has been like forcefully stuck because of her race.
Yeah.
And so she has less agency in that profession and in her career because it has been taken away from her.
Mm-hmm.
And that is such a critical difference between, I think, the so-called sad girl fiction that really tells me something that I haven't heard before or offers quite a unique, challenging perspective.
And it's nuanced.
And nuanced, exactly. That's the word I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. It's much more nuanced. And it should be, it to me is still really relatable. I'm still getting that if we want to call it that, sort of like Bridget Jones effect of, you know, reading about a young woman who's struggling with similar things. Mm-hmm. But there's a bit more depth and a bit more nuance to it.
Yeah, no, I love that answer. SAG Girl novels also get a lot of praise for spotlighting women's mental illness and women's issues in these books, especially when it comes to like power dynamics, competitiveness among other women, loneliness. Do you think the genre helps or hinders these issues from being taken more seriously? And do you think it starts good conversations?
My starting point with this kind of thing is pretty much always anything that allows and encourages women to reflect upon their experiences and discuss those experiences with other women mm-hmm. is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Me Too wouldn't have happened without women being encouraged to think about their own experiences and then share those experiences. Mm-hmm. I love the way books and book culture and book chats, like even this podcast, this wouldn't have happened 10 years ago.
Yeah.
This is a really exciting development. And if so-called sad girl novels mean that more women are thinking about whether the thing that they've experienced is similar or different to the protagonist and then hearing about other women's experiences at a book club or reading about them in the other like reviews online or on Instagram, all good. These are all good things. A generalization I feel comfortable making is that if somebody is trying to make you feel bad for reflecting on and sharing your life experiences, mm-hmm. that person's probably a fuckwit. There are absolutely important arguments to be had about, you know, whose voice gets heard when they do want to share those experiences and even which voices are getting published in this format. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But in general, as a starting point, more conversation about women's experiences, good thing.
But since the protagonists are usually white, they romanticize, I don't know if that's the right word, but they romanticize a type of feminine instability. Instability was a bit generous. That is that is only like relatable and digestible to other white women. But when the subject is marginalized, I don't know if society is even ready for that sometimes to have that conversation.
This is a really interesting topic that I think Elfie Scott has done a huge amount of great work on. And her book is not at all a sad girl novel. It's nonfiction. It's called The One Thing We've Never Spoken About. And it's about her mother's diagnosis of schizophrenia. And what I think is so valuable that that book and Elfie's work has been doing is showing that, unfortunately, I'm not saying this is a good thing. I'm saying it is a thing. There are like acceptable and sort of almost digestible types of mental health issues mm-hmm. and mental health challenges. And then there are the ones that, you know, as the title of her book says, we don't talk about.
Yeah.
And I think, frankly, with a bit of hindsight, like in terms of the race component as well, it's analogous to the voices that we do hear from survivors in the Me Too space. There is a reason that the sort of face of the Me Too movement in Australia is overwhelmingly white, you know, and for the most part, comfortably middle class. If you enjoy these sort of cross sections of privilege, it's much more kind of palatable for a mainstream audience to see when you do struggle with things.
Yeah.
A mainstream audience in Australia apparently is still not ready for like, what, too many intersections?
Yeah.
I don't know if I... The fact that that is what we see more of means that it is true. Mm-hmm. What I wish is that all the creative industries and the media, and this is where my cynicism comes in, I wish they thought a bit more highly of their audience.
Yeah.
Publish more of those books and let us relate to them. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there is, in the media in particular, I think there is a lot of preemptive gatekeeping. Because they think that people won't click or they won't read or they won't care. Mm. And maybe I'm too much in my little bubble, but I think we need to give the public a chance.
I agree. Do you think it's changing?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yes. Undoubtedly. Since I started, well, basically since I quit law, so like in 2016, a couple of years before Eggshell Skull came out, mm-hmm. there are still huge, huge problems. But what I believe I have witnessed during that time is a shifting of the center. There are conversations I was having in 2018 about all of these interconnected issues of agency and class, and Me Too and race and mental health and, you know, the perfect victim and all of these interconnected things. Yep. There were conversations I was having that were considered like radical left, which are now considered left of center.
Yeah.
And on the days that I get bummed out about the lack of progress, I really try hard to remember that.
Mm. And in the grand scheme of things, that is a lot of progress.
In a comparatively short number of years.
Yeah.
Still a long way to go, but there is reason to hope.
Mm. So I have to ask, at the risk of sounding a little bit like not like other girls, I'd argue, I just wanted to be self-aware.
Yeah.
I'd argue the work is in many ways an antithesis of a sad girl novel. Were you intentionally trying to deviate from the genre, or did it come naturally?
Sometimes people talk about what you are writing along with and what you are writing against.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I was writing the work against so-called sad girl novels.
Yeah.
Not because I don't enjoy them. I have read a billion of them. And like any genre, there are great ones and there are terrible ones.
Yeah.
But that's not the book that I wanted to write.
Yeah.
And to go back to the protagonist's comparative ages, it's not lost on me. I was just thinking about that this morning, that when I started writing this book, I was Pat's age. And now that I've finished writing it and I'm about to tour it, I'm Lally's age.
Yeah.
And in a way, I've kind of, like, I really relate to both of these protagonists. I love them both. I hate them both. They're complicated human beings. But I'm really glad and I'm really heartened and I'm really relieved that now that I am basically the same age as Lally, I feel that her experience as a woman in her early 30s is true to what the women in my life are going through and struggling with now. And it's not necessarily what I saw in 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021 from the so-called initial glut of sad girl novels.
Mm. Looking at the success of sad girl novels, were you concerned at all about you deviating from the trend not appealing to readers?
No, because I don't even know that it's, you know, I think it's a helpful framework for us to have conversations about culture.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a helpful framework to think about what people do and don't want to read.
Yeah.
Kind of. Also, honestly, anyone who writes a book trying to catch a wave will miss it. And also, I think a reader can sniff when a book has been written by someone just sort of trying to bullseye on some hot genre versus a book that has genuinely come from an artist.
Yeah, it's not authentic.
Yeah, yeah. Is it authentic or not? I respect my reader enough to know that they can get a sense pretty quickly for whether or not this book is authentically the book that I wanted to write at this time in my life.
Mm-hmm. So in my research, I came across a lot of discussion about whether the label sad girl novel is reductive or a product of the patriarchy. One listener, Erica, even wrote in to say, aren't sad girls novels just a way for women to express their full range of emotions? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's also, I just want to say, Erica, 100% correct. It's a marketing tool. I hope this is like really clear. I don't think the authors of these books are sitting down at their desk for months and years doing the painstaking labor of crafting believable, realistic lives of women and their interiority, thinking, oh, can't wait to get put on the table with the other sad girl novels.
Yeah.
Like, that's not... It's a marketing tool. It is a banner that helps people find more books that they might like because they liked this one.
Yeah.
And it's a marketing tool developed by the publicists and booksellers who, if authors like me are lucky, are doing that kind of work so that the authors don't have to.
Totally.
This comes back to my, you know, romance about the work, cynicism about the industry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want people to sort of conflate those two parts of the conversation. Even the terminology, even whether something gets described as, you know, a collection of essays, nonfiction versus memoir, those are just words that we have to allocate to books so that a bookseller knows what shelf to put them on. And so that
people know what to buy.
Yeah. These are not things that a good writer has in their mind when they are crafting the art they want to craft.
Yeah, absolutely. So we actually asked the listeners to send in some questions they'd like to ask you. And I've already kind of littered them throughout this episode, but I've handpicked some of my favorites.
Great.
So
thank you for everyone for your questions.
They sent so many in.
Oh,
thank you so much for sending them in.
I'm thrilled to hear it.
So I'll start with Daisy, who wrote in to ask, why don't we have a sad boy genre? Surely it's a little sexist. The listener didn't provide examples, but I imagine she means books like Perks of Being a Wallflower, Catcher in the Rye, and like every John Green book.
I would gently disagree with that, Sohani, and say that I think average commercial spy fiction is sad boy novel. You're talking about if a defining trope of sad girl fiction is a woman who either won't or can't like have great relationships with men and great sex with men, then sad boy novel is like a spy who either won't or can't have a decent relationship with any women.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, again, back to my sort of cynicism about the industry and about whose job is what, if you go to a bookstore or a publisher's marketing materials around Father's Day, you will see 20, 30, 40, 50 book covers that look identical. So-called fiction for men also gets packaged. It's often with sans serif font. There are explosions. There's a lot of black and white and red and gold. Names in big words. Like, books get sold. They are, you know, I'm romantic about the art that it is, and then cynical about the product that it is and how it is packaged and sold. There might not necessarily be currently an exact gender equivalent to the sad girl novel, but that does not mean that books, quote unquote, for men don't also get packaged in derivative and kind of, frankly, infantilizing.
Yeah.
But really obvious and helpful for marketing purposes ways.
Yeah. And the most common question we got from quite a few listeners was, what are alternative novels you'd recommend that reject the tropes in sad girl novels?
The Work by Brianna. I'm kidding. There is not just one book, but there is one author whose work that I absolutely adore. And all of her books are contemporary fiction. Her most recent one, as well as her first one, have several women in them. The first one in particular with a woman protagonist. Her name is Caoilín Hughes. It's spelled C-A-O-I-L-I-N-N, Hughes. She's Irish. Her first book, which I adored, is called Orchid and the Wasp. If you want to read about a young woman who has a lot of feelings, like fantastic capturing of the interiority of a woman of our sort of age and generation, but not with any of the sad girl tropes, Orchid and the Wasp, absolutely great starting point. Mm-hmm. And Caoilín has a brand new novel out called The Alternatives, comes out in April, and it is about four sisters. They're a little bit older than sort of millennial, but they do sort of span years. And that is extraordinary interiority and complicated women characters that is not at all sad girl trope.
All right, we're coming towards the end of the episode, and we always end these interviews with a quick fire round.
Ooh.
So, number one, what are you currently reading?
The Alternatives by Caoilín Hughes. Almost finished, cannot wait to finish.
Number two, roughly how many books do you read every year?
100+.
Nice. Number three, what book would you recommend to a friend going through a hard time?
I'm a big believer in comfort reads. Yeah. I think most people who are readers know what book they actually really want to go back to in their comfort times. And I don't like being kind of hierarchical about reading or precious about it or making it feel like vegetables.
What's your comfort read?
It's more like a genre. I go back to fantasy.
Oh, I love
it. I go back to genre fiction when I'm in a reading rut, and it just gives me exactly what I want and is beautiful escapism.
Yeah, that's my comfort read as well.
Yeah.
And when I was a teenager, I got really into those kind of books.
Totally.
And number four, what book deserves more hype than it gets?
Caoilín Hughes.
Sorry. She's getting so many shout-outs in this episode.
Well, just I think that Caoilín Hughes should be one of the like most famous household names in publishing in English right now. Mm-hmm. The thing I most love about her work is that it treats the reader like they are a smart person. Mm-hmm. She never dumbs anything down. Her characters are complex. The books explore really contemporary, huge issues without feeling like they are talking to you about important ideas.
Yeah.
And I just think that it's an absolute failing of the kind of publicity marketing infrastructure that she isn't already Pulitzer and Booker and multi-award winning.
Okay, Brie, we're at the end of the episode. This has been one of my favorite author interviews to record. This is such an interesting conversation. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. This is sort of properly popped my interview cherry for my novel. So. Really great time.
This podcast was recorded on Wurundjeri land. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
Oh, hi, it's Annabelle Lee and Louis Hansen here. We are your hosts of Everybody Has a Secret.
Woo!
Woo! We are here essentially just to let you know that we drop episodes every week now. Every damn Friday morning, we are in your ears.
That is so exciting. What a time to be in your ear holes. So essentially, each episode, we unpack the real life secrets of our listeners. So this is for everyone who loves, you know, just a little bit of gossip in their lives, which, let's be real, Annabelle, is all of us.
It's absolutely all of us. Don't lie. You all love gossip. So if you want to listen to our show, please do head to your favourite podcast app and listen now.
See you there.
Bye.